the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. This is Pardes from Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Vayakel Pikudei. This week, Nechama Goldman-Barash discusses Vayakel Pikudei. Nechama Goldman-Barash is a member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Nechama Goldman-Barash.
We're going to be taking a look at a particular verse that appears at the end of Vayakel, chapter 38, verse 8. Vayas et kiyor nechoshet ve et kano nechoshet b'marot hatzovot asher tzavu petach wal moed. He made the laver of copper and its stand of copper from the mirrors of the thronging women who thronged at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And what I'd like to discuss in this podcast is the significance of the mirrors, the significance of mirrors in general, and the significance of the mirrors of the women who left Egypt and went into the desert and followed Moshe and followed God and came to donate their mirrors at this particular time in Jewish history. If we think about mirrors, mirrors serve a number of purposes. We look in a mirror so that we can see what we look like. Without a mirror, we actually have no idea of what our reflection looks like. We can't see our faces, so we don't really know who we are or how others see us. We also, if we want to think more deeply about it, can look at ourselves and think more deeply about who we are, you know, the ravages of time that pass, if we're in a good mood, if we're in a bad mood. All of that can be reflected when we look in a mirror. In addition, the angle of the mirror, the light of the mirror also matters. And so people will often meticulously hang mirrors in such a way so that they look younger or thinner when they look in the mirror. And so the question is, are mirrors really only for vanity? Is it just so, you know, I can reflect on how well I look or how not well I look or obsess about how much weight I've gained or how many pimples I have? Or is there something deeper inside the interaction between oneself and one's reflection that we can also think about as we learn this pasuk in the Torah? So what I'd like to do is take a look at some of the medievalists and what they have to say about mirrors. So we'll start with Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra, who's a medievalist who lives around 1100 CE, and he writes as follows: "The mirrors of the women who perform tasks. These were the skillful women who spun the five types of cloth previously mentioned. Or it may refer to the women who came regularly to pray at the tent and study the commandments. It is customary for every woman to make up her face every morning and look in a bronze or glass mirror in order to adjust her hairstyle and ornaments, as mentioned in Isaiah 3. So Ibn Ezra initially says the women who throng are the women who actually do jobs in the tabernacle. They were the women who spin the five types of cloth. They are the women who come regularly to pray and study. And they bring their mirrors, says Ibn Ezra, because initially the Israelite women behaved exactly as the Ishmaelite women today. But there were pious women in Israel who overcame this worldly temptation and freely gave away their mirrors because they found no more need to beautify themselves, but came instead daily to the door of the tent of meeting to pray and hear religious discourses for their edification. The text says who thronged at the door of the tent of meeting because there were many of them." So the Ibn Ezra says the many women who throng are the women who have interaction with the tabernacle, either because they have jobs to perform, they spin the types of cloth that are used in building the tabernacle, or because they're intuitively drawn to this space of holiness, and they come there to pray and to learn. And as a result, in the course of their engagement with this holy space, they've come to renounce vanity. That's what Ibn Ezra is saying. The glass mirror is something all women use. The Israelite woman like the Ishmaelite woman. The Ishmaelite woman is the non-Jewish prototype. And at this time, these Israelite women renounced their vanity because that's all Ibn Ezra sees in the mirror, a conduit for vanity. The Ramban says something, Nachmanides. He lives about 100 years after the Ibn Ezra. He says something a little different. "We may perhaps take it in its plain sense that he made the basin and stand out of the mirrors of women who crowded in a great host and assembled at the door of the tent of meeting to give their mirrors as a freewill offering. It may also be part of the straightforward meaning of the text to say that it was a vast army of women who gathered at the tent to give their mirrors voluntarily." So the Ramban feels that, again, like Ibn Ezra, many women crowded, or as I said earlier, thronged to the door of the tent of meeting to willingly, freely give their mirrors. And the Ramban then continues, he describes the mirror. The bronze of the mirrors was designated for this vessel because of its smooth, polished, hollowed out surface. When the women saw this, they trooped in army after army so that all of them could have their mirrors made into the laver and the stand. It is also correct to say that they understood right from the start that this laver, this basin, would be used to test the women who were suspected of adultery, and they accepted this joyfully and volunteered to bring all of their mirrors for this purpose. So Ramban says something a little bit different than Ibn Ezra. It's similar in that the women are renouncing vanity, the mirror representing a form of vanity. But he goes a little deeper in saying, first of all, they understood when they saw the structure of the basin, of the laver, that the mirrors would fit very well into the hollowed out surface. So it was a direct connection between the shape of the vessel as it emerged to the shape of their mirrors and how they saw the two could fit one into the other. In addition, Nachmanides, Ramban, adds another piece, which is they understood this basin was going to be used to test a woman accused of adultery. So for that, we have to pause for a moment and I'll explain. The woman who's accused of adultery, the sota, appears in the book of Numbers, chapter 5. A man who accuses his wife of adultery, either because she's committed adultery, but she hasn't been caught, so there are no witnesses, and he can't bring her before a court, or because he's jealous, a jealous spirit overtakes him, brings her before the high priest. And the way in which her innocence is tested is that the water of the basin is mixed with some dirt from the ground of the tabernacle, along with erasing the ink upon which God's name is written on parchment. So the ink that was God's name written on parchment is dissolved in the water, and essentially the woman drinks the water that's in the basin together with the erasure of God's name. And in this way, her innocence is proven, or her guilt is asserted. And so Nachmanides, Ramban, says that they understood that the water in the basin was going to be used to test women accused of adultery, and they joyfully trooped with their mirrors to be part of this, to be partners in this initiative, in this endeavor, because they too wanted to eradicate promiscuous or adulterous behavior, and they certainly wanted to vindicate innocent women. So either to eradicate adultery by having some sort of test that would catch the guilty, or alternatively, vindicate women who were innocently accused, and their mirrors that are used in the basin would be part of the process of cleansing the women's reputation. So again, Nachmanides seeing a direct connection between renouncing of mirrors and the purpose for which they are used in the tabernacle. The third voice I'd like to bring is Nachum Sarna, who died in the last century and was one of the foremost Bible scholars. And he writes as follows. In ancient times, mirrors were mainly of the kind held in the hand. They were highly polished discs of molten metal, copper or bronze, and were fitted with handles made of metal, wood, or ivory. Egypt was the manufacturing center of this article of toilet for the entire Near East. And so Nachum Sarna is not really reflecting on the renouncing of vanity. Rather, he's describing for us what the mirrors would have looked like. They would have been highly polished discs of molten metal. And he goes on to say that probably these women were women who performed menial work. These were probably women at the bottom of the occupational and social scale, because all they had to donate were their mirrors, were their even valuable bronze mirrors. What he basically suggests is all women would have owned mirrors. In fact, if you go to the Israel Museum, you can see remnants of mirrors that date back to this time and even earlier. All women would have had little hand mirrors in order to check their hair, check their teeth. Again, there's something very poignant about recognizing that women 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago were concerned with their appearance and so carried around little mirrors. And the wealthier women would have had gold and silver and diamonds and fabrics to donate to the tabernacle. But Nachum Sarna, in contrast to the Ibn Ezra and Ramban, says these weren't pious women particularly. These were women who were looking to give something very dear to them. It wasn't that they were renouncing vanity. They were looking for their dearest possession, and out of love for God and love for the tabernacle, they wanted to donate something, not that they were renouncing it, but that they were donating something they particularly loved. And so that's really a very different interpretation, and I think a very powerful interpretation, that the women weren't necessarily renouncing their vanity. Instead, they were giving something that was very beloved to them, something in which they checked themselves, something they held close to their bodies, something that they carried around with them. And this is the object that they choose to donate to the tabernacle. What I'd like to do at this point is read really one of my favorite midrashim. And I think in this midrash, we see elements of both Ibn Ezra and Nachmanides, Ramban, as well as what Sarna was saying. I'm going to choose the version in the midrash Tanchuma, even though this appears in Shmot Rabbah, another form of midrash, because I think this tells the most complete story. You find that when the Israelites suffered hard labor in Egypt, that Pharaoh decreed that they should not sleep at home nor have relations with their wives. So this is really bringing us back to the beginning of Shmot in order to pull us forward to where we are at the end of Shmot, at the end of Exodus. And it reminds us that when the Bnei Yisrael, the children of Israel, suffered hard labor in Egypt, Pharaoh decreed they should not sleep at home, probably because he didn't want to have to kill more baby boys than necessary. Meaning, again, this is a midrash. This is not in the text of the Torah. This is filling in narrative. And what it's suggesting is, in order to decrease the number of baby boys being thrown into the Nile, Pharaoh simplified things and simply forbade the men to sleep at home or have relations. Said Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta, what did the daughters of Israel do? They would go down to draw water from the river, whereupon the Holy One, blessed be He, prepared small fishes for them inside their jars. So let's pause for a minute. First of all, Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta suggests that the men comply, meaning in the mind of the men who think logically, according to the Midrash, this, what are we going to do? Sleep with our wives and bring babies into the world, especially baby boys who are going to be murdered? It makes no sense. There's another midrash that even actively portrays Amram, the father of Moshe, standing up and divorcing his wife, which leads to all the men of the generation actively divorcing their wives in order to avoid bringing baby boys into the world. And in that midrash, Miriam rebukes her father, Miriam, the sister of Moshe, and says, you've condemned the girls. Even Pharaoh didn't condemn the girls. You've condemned the girls as well as the boys, which leads Amram to remarry his wife and so on and so forth. And that leads to the birth of baby Moshe. But in the midrash we're looking at, Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta describes the daughters of Israel as refusing to despair. And what they go down to do is draw water from the river. And God prepares small fishes for them inside their jars. Small fishes, of course, are a sign of fertility, which shows that God is going to be complicit in their plan to continue procreating despite all odds. The women have the belief that they are going to be redeemed from Egypt, and they are not prepared to pause in their endeavor to raise up the hosts of the children of Israel and make sure there are as many Israelites as possible who are going to go out of Egypt. And so that what the women do is they cook the fish, sell some, and buy with the proceeds wine, and go out into the fields and give their husbands to eat there. And here too, we see tremendous initiative. They cook some of the fish, they sell some, they buy wine. If we're being careful as readers, we understand a seduction scene is about to unfold. They're going out to the fields, they're meeting their husbands who are forbidden from sleeping at home in the fields. After they have eaten, they take out their mirrors. And this is where the mirrors which we read about, the mirrors which were donated, come into the story. And they look into the mirrors together with their husbands. And at this point, the Midrash really surprises us. She says the Midrash, I am more beautiful than you. He says, I am more beautiful than you. So what's surprising here is normally if you want to seduce your partner, you don't compliment yourself. You don't hold the mirror out in front of the two of you, the man and the woman, and look into it and say, hey, honey, I'm more beautiful than you. That's usually not the way a seduction is going to unfold. Normally, what you suggest someone do is compliment the other person on their beauty, on their skin, on their body, on their hair, whatever it is, to get the intimacy to unfold. And here the women do something surprising. They hold up the mirror and they say, "I am more beautiful than you," which leads the man to look in the mirror and say, "No, wait a minute, I am more beautiful than you." Now, I often pause here and reflect that this could not have worked in reverse. In other words, if a man holds out a mirror to a woman and says, "Hey, babe, I'm more beautiful than you," chances are the woman is going to feel extremely insecure and begin to cry and say, "You don't really love me," and so on and so forth. This works very well when it comes to male ego. And I really appreciate the Midrash understanding the gender here, because she rouses the competitive ego in the man, who then, when the woman says, "I am more beautiful than you," hears the edge of competition and rises to the bait and looks in the mirror and says, no, wait a minute, I'm more beautiful than you." And in the course of this tete-a-tete, the Midrash says, their sexual desire was aroused. Now, I'm not saying you always have to gender it, but the Midrash is being written in 800 CE, and I think it is deliberately reflecting on the gender of the couple, because it understands that the woman understands that she has to get the man to look in the mirror. He's a downtrodden, beaten slave. He's essentially forgotten his identity. He's given in to whatever Pharaoh has decreed, and there's no one left to have babies with. There's no one to have a relationship with. It's imperative that she get her partner to look into the mirror and find his eye, find his self, remember who he is. And she can only do it by baiting or taunting his ego and getting him to say, wait a minute, you're saying I'm more beautiful than you? No, I am more beautiful than you. And in the course of that, desire is aroused because the man regains his sense of self. The woman has never lost her sense of self. She's never lost her purpose. Remember, she's the one with the mirror. So she has been using it throughout this period of time to see who she is. The men who are sleeping away from home have absolutely forgotten who they are and what it means to be in this relationship, both with their partner and with God. And so the woman really brings the man back, or the women bring the men back, through the use of the mirrors, this very erotic love play through the mirrors. And the Midrash continues, "They became fruitful and multiplied. The Holy One, blessed be He, forthwith remembering them, as it is stated, and the children of Israel were fruitful and swarmed and multiplied and became exceedingly mighty. It is written regarding them, and the land was filled with them. And the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied. Through the merit of those same mirrors," says the Midrash, "which they showed their husbands, arousing their sexual desire in the midst of the hard labor, they raised up all the hosts." Now, the Midrash continues because it skips forward a couple of decades and it moves to the scene in our Parsha, the scene in which the women donate the mirrors. "As soon as the Holy One, blessed be He, told Moses to make the tabernacles, all of Israel came along to contribute. Some brought silver, some gold, some brass, some onyx, some stones. And the women then said, 'What have we to contribute?' And they came and brought the mirrors and presented themselves to Moses." Now, in this narrative, this sounds more like Nahum Sarna's version. In other words, they're not renouncing vanity. They are giving up something that's very dear and very beloved to them, something that's actually symbolic of their intimacy with their husbands, not of their vanity. "Now, when Moses saw the mirrors, he was furious with them, because he," like the Ibn Ezra and the Ramban's commentary, "sees these as signs of vanity, and he doesn't believe symbols of vanity belong in a holy space like the tabernacle. And he says to the men, 'Take sticks and break the legs of those who brought them,'" actually the thighs of those who brought them. "What use are such mirrors?" He understands not only are these vehicles or conduits of vanity, they're conduits of sexuality. And Moshe, who we remember becomes celibate at a certain point in his life because he's so close to God, doesn't really understand the intimacy and the sexuality that these women are representing. And he wants to break their thighs. And God then says to Moses, "Moses, you look down on them. It was such mirrors, these mirrors, which raised up all these hosts in Egypt. take them and make out of them the basin and its stand for the priests, in which they can purify themselves, as it is said, and he made the basin from the mirrors. So God has to teach Moshe a lesson about intimacy, about mirrors, about self. And basically God is saying to Moshe, Moshe, you are Moshe. But I can't have a whole generation of Moshe Rabbeinus. We won't survive. The nation won't be able to survive. They have to multiply. They have to become mighty. They have to be, the land has to be filled with them. And the women who understood this at a time where it was counterintuitive to bring life into the world, these mirrors symbolize their belief in me, says God. And I want those mirrors to be in holy space, in the place in which my presence rests. And they will be the first step in which the priests who come to work in my tabernacle will purify themselves. And I think at this point, I want to just share very quickly an idea from Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. The Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, who wrote in the 1800s, says, on one hand, mirrors are articles which lay stress on the physical bodily appearance of people. On the other hand, the Mishkan, the tabernacle, does not exclude the physical sensual side of human beings from sanctification. In other words, the physical sensual side is the first and most essential object of this sanctification. So the Midrash, which portrays Moshe as wary, even perhaps critical of the physical sensual side, is forced to understand through God's rebuke that really this is also something that can be sanctified and will become part of the process of sanctification. And the last idea I really want to share is what the priests are forced to do when they go to work in the tabernacle. The first thing they really have to do is wash their hands and feet in this basin and laver made of mirrors. And I think ultimately what they're being forced to do or asked to do, if we're being honest, is to look at themselves. We started off by saying mirrors are something we can use to check whether we have food in our teeth or if our hair is straight, whether we're too fat or too thin. But we can also use the mirror to recognize who we are on many, many levels. And I think the priests looking in the mirrors before they go to work is very, very powerful, because you can wear the clothes and you can walk the walk and talk the talk. But if you don't look at yourself before you go to work in the Mishkan, which is supposed to be holy place, and ask yourself, who am I today? How am I? What am I bringing into my service of God? Am I really representing the people, or am I just wearing the uniform? Is something that we can reflect upon as well when we get up in the morning and, you know, we look in the mirror. Who am I today? Am I bringing my best self to whatever is, wherever I'm going, to my community, to my synagogue, to the classroom if I teach, to the medical clinic if I'm a doctor? Meaning using the mirror, not just to look at superficially what we look like, but who we are underneath, can certainly make us more mindful in whatever spiritual and mundane spaces we interact in. Shabbat shalom.
Thank you, Nechama Goldman Barash. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.